I've framed this presentation in a kind of dichotomous way, you know, help or hindrance. But I want to point out that I don't think of it in a dichotomous way. So it's not a question of, is it possible, is it not possible? The idea is to kind of break down the kind of different layers and analyze them separately so that you can have a vocabulary and a toolbox to think, well, you know, where are the helps and where are the hindrances? And Carola very kindly just mentioned a report that I did in parallel with the UNESCO assessment of media development indicators in Jordan. And this was about public service broadcasting. And in a way, what I want to do here is continue sort of a conversation that I had with that report in presenting that report, because I made kind of three introductory points. One was, you know, do we call it nowadays public service broadcasting or public service media? Because actually, any broadcaster worthy of the name and any serious regulatory body, yeah, any serious broadcaster nowadays, public service one, will be operating online, and the regulatory body that's in charge of it will be expecting it to operate online. So should we talk about broadcasting or media? Secondly, there is a wide consensus on not only the definition of public service media, but also the need for it. Hence all these reports that have been done about public service broadcasting in countries that don't have it. But the point that I want to elaborate on here is neither of those. It's, which also Sarah already said, that public service broadcasting is more than an activity. It's a philosophy. And I thought it worth like concentrating on this a bit, because UNESCO organized a kind of a dialogue with people in broadcasting in Jordan. And when we were talking about the topic of public service, it kept coming back to the broadcaster as institution and the concept of, you know, broadcasting as a way of broadcasting as a philosophy was quite hard to sort of hold on to and get across. So that's why I've used the word ecology. Media production ecologies is quite a useful concept if you don't want to be dichotomous, if you want to be able to look at things as a spectrum of possibilities and hindrances. Simon, so I have to be true to my, you know, it's a bit academic and a bit abstract, but I quote Simon Cottle in his 2003 edition of Media Organization and Production, where he uses the term. He was writing about natural history TV, but he talked about the production ecology. And I've put the, it's characterized by a set of competitive, institutional relationships and cooperative dependencies. Before you get stuck into that, let me say that Cottle builds on Bourdieu's idea of the cultural field, so which is from the 1980s. And when Bourdieu says field, he means a field of forces and a field of struggles. So the notion is all about relationality. So when Cottle takes the idea of the field and uses it in relation to ecology, it means we are not just talking about players, not just talking about practices, not just about relationships, but all of them and the dynamics between them. So ecology, like an ecosystem, when we apply it to the media, it gives us the possibility of understanding organizational relationships and practices, and as well as the individuals and the organizations. So we can get a sense of internal factors and external factors. You're going to find a lot of stuff in this presentation that has already been said yesterday and also now by Sarah. Public service broadcasting or media, it's, you know, when you look at the definitions, it's all about outcomes. So if you go to UNESCO, if you go to the Council of Europe, as I've done here, if you go to the Public Media Alliance, if you go to the European Broadcasting Union, and I've taken the Council of Europe summary, they don't talk about particular organisations. What they describe are mechanisms and outcomes. So, reference point for all members of the public offering universal access. Factor for social cohesion and integration, as we've already heard. Impartial and independent information, etc. A forum for pluralistic discussion and democratic participation. So, if we take the European Broadcasting Union, which is relevant because Egypt belongs to it, their General Assembly in 2012 agreed on six core values, which were universality, independence, diversity and innovation, or distinctiveness, which we've already seen, plus excellence and accountability. When you look at those, they are the characteristics of a type of media output, not necessarily of an organisation. So if you're trying to aim at these outcomes, you need the right ecosystem. And none of what I'm saying is new, but I'm just saying it because I want to provide a bit of an antidote to this notion that reform is all about what happens inside broadcasters, you know, without reference to the huge array of factors that affect, that impinge on the broadcaster. So, back in 2011, 6 weeks after the revolution, I was privileged to be involved in a conference about media regulation. And my colleague, Professor Stephen Barnett, spoke there, and he's much more an expert than I am. And this point about ecology, basically, I learned it from him, so I'm just passing it on. And here's what he told the conference. There's a mistaken assumption that public service broadcasting and a publicly funded broadcaster are interchangeable concepts. In fact, they are fundamentally different. Although a publicly funded broadcaster is an integral and more obviously accountable element of any nation's broadcasting ecology, public service broadcasting is a motivating and more all-encompassing philosophy which can and should apply to varying degrees across the board. So, he uses the word ecology, describes it as a philosophy, and if we look at the features of this ecosystem that is friendly to public service broadcasting, it, as Sarah has already said, sorry for the duplication, commercial broadcasters can be obliged by the terms of their license to carry public service content because there are types of output that are expensive to produce, and you know, if you leave it to the market, you won't get them. So news, certain types of documentary, children's content, etc. Broadcasters also in this system can be obliged to carry a minimum quota of homegrown programming because the simple and cheap thing to do is import stuff and subtitle it, as we know very well from the umpteen NBC channels. If you are obliged to carry homegrown programming, that is good for local creative industries. It's good for the public, like I said, because people are interested in themselves. They want to see content that relates to them. And it's good for keeping a level playing field for the different players in the landscape. And then also, you know, public service is not a single ownership model that relates to public service. There can be different. People talk in the UK, they always talk about the BBC. People forget Channel 4. It's privately funded. It makes 900 million a year, but it has a public service remit to serve minorities and to be distinctive and innovative. So, I think it's interesting that public service has achieved so much more attention in recent years in the context of media development. And these two examples, Deutsche Welle Akademie, last year they produced, and now the very new report that Sarah has co-authored, both talk about transforming state broadcasters. In the BBC case, that is the whole purpose of the exercise, to suggest that national broadcasters could be promoting social cohesion. In the Deutsche Welle Akademie case, they do look a bit more broadly. They categorise existing studies of public service in terms of whether they focus on content, management or audience, and then they go beyond this to talk about ethos and what they call key areas in a strategic model of media development towards a public service media system. And I strongly recommend those reports to anyone interested. The Deutsche Welle conclusion is really interesting. But here, the reason I'm just showing them to you is that when bodies that promote media development talk about public service broadcasting, there is this tendency always to talk about broadcasters and not to tackle enough elements of the wider legal and social fabric. Okay, I haven't mentioned Egypt so far. Somebody said this yesterday, that there are no kind of agreed standards for broadcasting in Egypt. And these are random. I mean, I've just chosen these four screenshots to highlight issues, like to introduce us to some of the wider issues in the social and legal fabric. There's millions more examples, unfortunately. Well, not millions, probably quite a lot. Incidents of incitement, incidents of threats on TV, and so on. But all I'm demonstrating here, and I'll talk about these individual examples in a minute, but is the lack of agreement on standards, okay? So if you're thinking help or hindrance, there are people who know what the standards are and who would like to see them agreed and enforced. And there are other people saying it's hopeless, you know, it's all random, and freedom of expression means you can say anything about anyone, which it doesn't. And I say this as somebody from the UK who knows all about the impact. When you have lack of agreement on standards, you end up with a tabloid press like we have in the UK, with the hacking and the awful treatment of people. And which led to the Leverhulme inquiry. And I hope everyone in the room, I know it's UK-centric, but the Leverhulme inquiry was a kind of a big issue about press standards. And what it showed was that the editors of those rubbish newspapers are out of step with the feelings of the general public, because the feelings of the general public were with the people who had been treated so badly by those newspapers. And I would say in Egypt, there's a similar kind of strength of feeling, about this kind of, you know, free-for-all, and the fact that people can be so badly treated. The example on the top left is something that happened in the ONTV programme Manchette, which is presented by Gabriel Almouti. And my source was Al-Arabiya website. So clearly someone found it fairly shocking. So I tell you what happened, in case you don't know. It's two children who heard about their mother's death when their father reveals it to them on air. So they're sitting in the studio, and the father has heard that the mother died in hospital. He's been called to talk about something to do with her being in hospital. During the program, he reveals that he knew at 20 to 6 that morning that the mother died, and the children are hearing it for the first time. And the presenter, they just cut to an ad break. So, I mean, you know, how could that... It can only happen, something like that, if you are lacking strict guidelines about children appearing on TV, and if there's kind of like not a consensus about children's, you know, sensitivity to children's feelings. And probably there is a consensus, but nobody's kind of captured it and brought it together. The second one is on the right, top right, I'm going sort of clockwise. Mona Lerai, on the presenter on Al-Mustahabi, which is Al-Qahira Wan-Nas channel. They trailed in advance that raid on the bathhouse that they did, as that was their contribution to World AIDS Day. And it was wrong on so many levels, and as demonstrated by the fact that all the people who were rounded up and, as it were, defamed by this, were released afterwards. Bottom left, Rehan Said, who was mentioned yesterday, and Yosri has made his views about this known. she's host of a Sabah El Khair on the Nahar channel, and this particular screenshot is from the episode where she blames the victim of an assault in a shopping mall in Heliopolis. A woman gets hit, and so Rehan Said's contribution is to bring pictures of the woman in a bikini and say it's all your fault for being underdressed. And then also, if you have 45 minutes to spare, you can watch on YouTube Rehan Said's program about distributing Egyptian rice and candy bars and clothes to Syrian refugees in Lebanon. And the camera work and the script is really quite upsetting in terms of like dehumanizing. So you see Rehan sitting in this truck with this sort of throng of people around her. So the camera is kind of looking down on them in a very kind of unpleasant and unedifying way. Right, so who's responsible for this? Who licenses the media in Egypt? Who could be helping to set the standards in Egypt in consultation with the public? well, historically, because private broadcasters don't have access to the spectrum, as we were shown yesterday, they are licensed by the General Authority for Investment and Free Zones, which has stepped in over content in the over the years, but not necessarily for issues like the ones I've just demonstrated. Yes, the Ministry of Information was dissolved in the middle of last year, but the head of the ERTU was given ministerial powers at that point, as I understand it, pending, and Hussein will probably enlighten us much more. Okay, until now. Pending creation of the regulatory bodies that were mandated in the 2014 Constitution. And now, have I written national authority? Yeah, I got this term. Sorry, Mustafa. Mustafa put me right on this. I got the name National Authority of Media and Journalism Legislation from Maga Moss, but actually it's National Legna, you know, National Committee for Media. And this is the group that was started off being mostly ERTU people and then was widened to include some journalists. And anyway, it's the people who are drafting the law to provide for the Supreme Media Council, which is stipulated by Article 2011 of the Constitution.
it's called the National Committee for Media and Press Legislation.
Media and Press Legislation. Okay, so so half vowels are, okay. But it exists, and they're working on a law, and they drafted a law which came out in August. Now, I wait to hear what we're going to hear from the rest of the panel and also from the discussion. But I find it extremely odd the way the Constitution kind of predetermined how the media will be organized prior to its being regulated. Because Article 211 creates a council for all the media that are not state-owned. And then the state-owned media get their own bodies. So they're kind of outside of that. And they're separated between broadcast and print in the age of media convergence. You know? The idea of print and broadcast being separate is strange. Okay, now, if the time is pressing, if this were a longer paper, if I had the space and I would look at more elements of the social makeup, that are needed, you know, like which are the ones that can support PSB because they are there, and which are the ones that are not helping. An important one is, how are media professionals organised and represented? And basically, the law in Egypt gives the government control over these processes. And aligned with that law is this kind of web of questionable interconnections, due mainly to the fact that so much media is in government hands. So the process of So what should journalists be doing? What should media professionals be doing? And what are they perfectly capable of doing? And what are they doing quietly and discreetly? Setting and defending high standards for journalism in Egypt. But to actually do that out in the open in a kind of institutionalized way is blocked by all these interlinked structural hurdles. And those hurdles contravene Egypt's obligations under ILO conventions. So the ILO, under the ILO, there should be freedom for union creation and representation. And so hence I've put this quote from Mother Moss about the, you know, immediately after the revolution, there was Ahmed Borai said, you know, all we need to do is comply with the ILO. I don't need to write a new labour law. But actually, all that's kind of gone by the wayside and drifted towards, the withering away of these independent associations. But the fact that they have existed, can exist, etc., is positive. It's not all a question of doom and gloom, as was suggested by a questioner previously. Okay, media ownership models, if we're going to race through. I've got 5 more minutes, I think. Okay, the thing I learned about when I worked with Article 19 a long time ago was that basically you don't need to reinvent the wheel, because so many of the challenges and dilemmas of trying to adhere to human rights, international human rights norms, and, you know, be fair to the people. So much of that has already been kind of mapped out, you know, and people have thought about it. So, you know, you don't have to look far for an alibi to tell you about the different, you know, how reasonable it is to have different media ownership models. And this is a joint declaration in 2007 by no less than these 4 bodies: UN Special Rapporteur, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Organization of American States, and the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, AACHPR. These 4 mandates on freedom of expression have said that there should be different types of broadcasters: commercial, public service, and community. They should be able to operate on and have equitable access to all available distribution programs. So that's a consensus from the Global North and the Global South about this equality of distribution. And if you only have to think back to what Hafiz showed us yesterday on the frequencies, and you can see how far away the status quo in Egypt is from what is recognised internationally, starting with the fact that community media are not recognised, and including, very obviously, the lack of equality in distribution. Right, now this is my last slide. And I think it's important to say that there is absolutely no reason why the Egyptian public should know or care about public service broadcasting by that name, because they've never experienced it. Because foreign broadcasters, when they broadcast abroad, that's not public service. What they do abroad is foreign policy stuff. You know, it's part of what the BBC overseas was financed by the Foreign Office for all these years, Voice of America, etc. That's, you know, the BBC internally, that's paid for by the license fee, that is public service. But why would Egyptians have any experience of that? So in order for people to be convinced of the arguments for PSB, there's a few prerequisites, and I've just put 3 headings here. I don't want to be rude about Egyptian education, because I know there's lots of bright spots. But I'm just quoting AUC, and we have AUC colleagues here, about debating skills. And I know that there's, you know, debating skills have been developed in the last couple of years. But if the philosophy of public service broadcasting is based on the idea of balance and inclusiveness, you need those concepts to be nurtured through the education system. You know, children need to learn to listen to each other, etc., from a very early age. And the consensus, I think, you know, if you're going to generalize about state education in Egypt, is that it doesn't favor critical thinking and also not doesn't give openings for students to have their voices heard. I read in a trusted source, and I'd be interested to know if this is really true, that in 2011, in the end of year exams, students, one of the exam questions was for students to write a letter to SCAF thanking them for their role in the January 25 uprising. So, what's taught in schools and universities influences people's readiness to engage in dialogue. And I think it's worth noting that the famous dialogue programs, of whom we have representatives here, have kind of given way to more and more ranting on TV. So I take this term, Barami Kawaria, Hafez al-Marazi did a show in his Men Washington series a long time ago, but I suppose it was, and it must have been after Tesaindi'i started, because it would have been 2006, 2007. And he had Monashazli, Mu'taz Demirdash, Mahmoud Saad talking in his Men Washington program, and he used this term, dialogue programs. And I mean, you know, when you look at Tawfiq Okasha and Amr Adib and these people, you know, like going on, just sitting there talking, this term pontificator monologues, I got that from Magda Boufadil, who's a Lebanese journalist. And I just think it says it all. And that's the kind of thing, you know, with the personal attacks and the smearing and so on, that people think that's what freedom of expression means, but it doesn't. And lastly, and I really will stop here, accountability of political leaders. You may have seen pictures of when Sisi came to the UK, you may have seen television pictures of Sisi and Cameron standing in number 10 Downing Street at the lectern with the mics, right? There was two journalists in the room. One British, one Egyptian. The British was deputy political editor of ITV. So you got the impression that there was some kind of press conference going on, but it wasn't a press conference worthy of the name. And one of the sketch writers that was, you know, that was had wanted to attend and had been barred, said he joked that, you know, given President Sisi's treatment of journalists, clearly David Cameron was looking out for the safety of the Brits. So, thank you.